Section 7. Elements of Christian Development. Element 19. The Apostle Paul is the earliest known Christian writer, yet he did not know a living Jesus, but was converted by revelation sometime after Jesus is said to have died, and did not begin writing anything we know of until many years after his conversion. Galatians, for example, was written about 17 years later, as we learn in Galatians 1, verse 18, and 2, verse 1. Element 20. The earliest known Christians proselytized Gentiles, but required them to convert to Judaism. Paul is the first known Christian to discard that requirement, having received a special revelation instructing him to, and he had to fight the earliest known leaders of the cult for acceptance of that radical idea. But some books in the New Testament are from the sect that did not adopt this innovation but remained thoroughly Jewish. Most obviously, this would be Matthew, the letters of John and James, and Revelation. Most scholars concede this. The primary evidence is Galatians 1 and 2, and supporting that is the fact that, in his extended defense of this novelty in Romans, Paul is unable to cite the authority of a historical Jesus even once. See, for example, Romans 14, verse 14. This entails that if Jesus lived, then he never taught anything other than a Jewish religion for Jews, and countenanced admitting only those Gentiles who first became Jews through circumcision and adherence to Torah law, such as Jewish dietary requirements and Sabbath observance, although possibly all rituals pertaining to the temple had been replaced by the cult paid to Christ. Just compare 1 John 2 with 1 John 5. As such, a procedure for converting Gentiles was already in accordance with Torah law, as we see in Exodus 12, verse 48. Element 21. Paul and other New Testament authors attest that there were many rival Christian sects and factions teaching different gospels throughout the first century. In fact, evidence of such divisions and disagreements date as far back as extant records go. Yet we know very little about these other versions of Christianity, and in some cases, nothing at all. And of these, only a few amalgamated sects survived the process of competition to remain in the Middle Ages, and those sects controlled nearly all choices as to what texts to preserve into the present and which texts to ignore or abandon. And for the former, they also had complete custody of those texts for over 1,000 years of hand copying and editing. This last point hardly needs defense, but does require qualification. There are comparatively few exceptions of texts that were preserved by Jews and Muslims, but none of those both date prior to the 4th century and pertain in any direct sense to the origins and development of Christianity, and equally few that have been recovered archaeologically, for example, in papyri, inscriptions, coins, and so forth, but almost none of those pertain in any direct sense to the origins and development of Christianity, while those that do are extremely few, extremely sparse in content, and generally late, mid-second century at the earliest, and most much later. Of course, Paul mentions factions sometimes advocating one apostle's teaching over another, and argues Christians should accommodate them all and not make divisions. Paul names himself, Apollos, and Kephas, or Peter, in 1 Corinthians 1 verse 12 and 3 verses 4 to 22, although supposedly Paul and Apollos regarded themselves as teaching roughly the same thing, as we see in 1 Corinthians 4 verse 6 and 16 verse 12. And Paul and Peter came to a somewhat uneasy détente, with Peter accepting Paul's innovative Torah-free gospel, and Paul accepting Peter's continuing adherence to a Torah-observant gospel in Galatians 2. But Paul also frequently refers to gospels of Jesus Christ so alien to his own that they must be declared anathema and shunned. We learn of this in Galatians 1 verses 6 to 10, in 2 Corinthians 11 verses 4 to 15, and in Romans 16 verses 17 to 18. And many other New Testament texts likewise allude to various early Christian sects being condemned, but almost never described. We therefore cannot simply assume surviving texts report what was normative for the original or earliest sects of Christianity. There is a great deal we just don't know, and we have to factor that ignorance into our reasoning, as many scholars have pointed out. The epistles, written during the first generation of Christians from the 30s to the 60s AD, reveal a highly fragmented church already from the earliest recorded time, rife with fabricated new gospels and teachings effectively beyond the control of any central authority. And if this much divergence had already occurred in Paul's generation, the amount of divergence in later generations would have been even greater. There is no guarantee that all the beliefs originally touted by Paul, for example, would even be those to survive the ensuing competition among rival factions. We already know that the teachings of the original apostles did not survive that competition. Jewish Christianity stagnated and died out, and we have almost no texts from it. And we know the teachings of even Orthodox Christianity, in the second century, deviated considerably from the simpler faith taught by Paul, for whom there was no Trinity, for example, nor was Jesus identical to God, and a great deal else besides. And yet, the so-called Orthodox Christianity of that century was no more likely to be closer to original Christianity than any of the countless other sects its adherents deemed heretical, and we can easily see how incredibly diverse and bizarre they were. Thus, if Christian sectarian divergence was already considerable in the early first century, and very considerable in the following century, we must assume it was somewhere in between in the late first century, which entails there must have been quite a lot of practically unknown divergence and development in that period, far more even than indicated in the letters of Paul for the generation preceding it. Element 22. We have no credible or explicit record of what happened within the Christian movement between 64 and 95 AD, or possibly even as late as 110 AD. And unlike almost any other cult we might consider for comparison, we know the leadership of the Christian church had been catastrophically decimated by the beginning of that period. Given that Acts is not a paragon of reliability, one might doubt whether we even have a reliable record of what went on before 64. The authentic letters of Paul would then be all we really had, and they all date generally to a single late decade, that of the 50s. Likewise, the evidence of ecclesial events for the whole three or four decades after 95 is not what one would characterize as robust either. Indeed, the fact that 1 Clement was written in 95 is really a traditional date and not actually secured by any trustworthy evidence. In fact, I am fairly certain it was written in the 60s, as I'll discuss in chapter 7 and 8. But even if we set all that aside and look on what we have with as rosy a view as we can stomach, then we can still say that nothing we have says anything about what happened between 64, the year of the Neronian persecutions, as reported in Tacitus and Suetonius, and 95, the year that 1 Clement was traditionally written. This is effectively a dark age in the early church, a 30-year black box in which we can't reconstruct what happened. In fact, we can barely reconstruct what happened in the 10 years either side of that, which makes for 50 years, half a century, of largely untracked development within the movement. Back then, that was an average human lifetime. Even texts that may have been written in that 30-year zone, like perhaps some of the Gospels, do not discuss any developments or events in that period. The only record of events in the church that has any chance of being other than fictional comes centuries later, since wildly implausible hagiographies and legends in the interim are hardly credible, as we'll see, for example, in discussion in chapter 8 of Papias and Hegesippus. And that one thing I was referring to is only the succession of bishops recorded in Eusebius, which is devoid of any historical information but the names and offices. Such succession lists are typically untrustworthy anyway, as gaps in succession lists, such as for philosophical schools, were always intolerable and thus would be filled by fabrication if necessary. And Eusebius exhibits a reliance on unreliable sources for his list, for example, Hegesippus, which only confirms our suspicions. In contrast, in the sources we have before Eusebius tried to smooth things over, we see much less certainty about what happened. For example, the inconsistent lists of apostles scattered across the four Gospels demonstrates that, by the time the Gospels were composed, which disciples belonged to the 12 was no longer known, and thus fundamental facts about the cult's own history and leadership had been lost already in the course of the first century. This was surely the one detail that should have been easily and consistently remembered for generations, unless, some major disruption in the cult's traditions had occurred. Instead, already by the second half of the first century, the leadership council of the Twelve, if such there was, no longer existed and left no identifiable heirs, and no one could even remember who all was on it or even what had happened to them. Indeed, for most of them, there are no historical accounts at all, beyond very late and obviously fabricated legends, and for the rest, the accounts we have, such as in Acts, either assume or establish their early deaths, or don't seem aware of what happened to them at all. By contrast, we have a lot of scattered information about the people, events, and schisms within Christianity in the middle and later decades of the second century, but near total silence for the 30 to 50 years of the latter first to early second century. Acts presents us with a history of the church movement from its origins in the 30s to around 60 or 62 AD, although still omitting a great deal. For example, it says almost nothing about Egyptian or North African Christianity, or Christianity east of the empire, or even Christianity in Italy and points west. It tells us little about the rival factions of Christianity, such as that of Apollos, and so on. But oddly, nothing else like this was ever again produced for over two centuries, unless, of course, Acts is as bogus as the many apocryphal Acts generated in the second century. And if that's the case, then we don't really even have the history of the church to the year 62. Because apart from Acts, we have only the letters of Paul, all produced during the end of that same period. The last authentic letter of Paul is unlikely to date much later than where Acts ends. The only thing we next hear is that the Neronian persecution wiped out Christianity at Rome, possibly after Rome burned in 64 AD. Although no Christian ever recorded any information about this event, it is known, even to medieval Christian writers, only through Tacitus, which suggests either the story is a fiction or that the event produced a rather complete destruction of all Christian witnesses at Rome. Of course, if this event never happened, and I suspect it didn't, then we are even more in the dark about the fate and progress of Christianity at Rome. And then the Jewish War between 66 and 70 AD wiped out Christianity at Jerusalem, home of the original church. Again, no Christian record of what happened to any Christians or their churches in Judea during this event was ever made, at least none known to us, suggesting again a rather thorough eradication. A decade or two before that, most likely around 47 AD, a famine had also ravaged the Middle East, the main proving grounds of Christian evangelism at the time, which would also have considerably reduced the normal life expectancy of the church membership, especially its leaders, insofar as leadership always tended to be elderly. Though it's possible some of the leadership escaped all of these events, we actually have no evidence any did. From 60 to 95, all authentic letter writing within the church ceases for the whole 30 years, a chilling sign. And no one writing after that period indicates that anyone survived those events. Certainly neither Peter nor Paul, nor any other apostle from their time is known to have survived beyond the year 70. There are some claims to be found that the disciple John survived into the second century, but Eusebius reveals this to be mistaken, as that John was often being confused with a different and later John. The odds are already hundreds or even thousands to one against anyone having lived from the early 30s AD into the reign of Trajan, in other words, around 100 AD, as was being claimed of John, and that only in unreliable sources many generations later. In fact, life expectancy in the ancient world was already short, even in times of plenty, much less when a massive war, persecution, and famine are added to further cull numbers. On this and my following statistical remarks, I follow the data provided in T.G. Parkin's Demography and Roman Society. There we learn if John was around 15 when he was made an apostle, he would be around 85 by the year 100, which has a probability of survival less than 1 in 200. If John was 25 at the start, then he would be 95 by year 70, which would have odds of thousands to one against. The odds only decline exponentially from there, and again, this is without factoring in the war, famine, and persecutions. Even in the best of times, no more than 1 in 3 people made it to 55 or above. Yet if anyone started in the apostolate at, for example, age 15 in the year 30, they would be 55 in the year 70. And it is far more likely the first apostles were in their 20s or 30s, not teenagers, which would make them around 65 or 75 in the year 70. Teenagers would have incredible difficulty earning the respect or deference of those in their 20s or 30s, much less of elder folk, and therefore would be ineffective as evangelists. So it is very unlikely the first apostles were of teen age. Indeed, such a thing would be so remarkable, it could not have failed to have been remarked upon in the sources we have. Yet only 1 in 5 teenagers would reach age 65, and barely 1 in 20 would make it to age 75, and that's without wars, famines, and persecutions reducing their survival rate. Factor those in, and we can expect none of the original 12, if 1 Corinthians 15:5 is to be trusted, will have made it much beyond the year 75, to which age the chances of a 25-year-old surviving are only 1 in 8 in normal conditions. Combine these prior expectations with the lack of any reliable evidence of anyone so surviving, and the silence of evidence against it, such as the complete absence of letters or writings from, to, or about these or any other leaders composed in that period, and we must conclude that, in all probability, the original leaders were dead by then. The significance of all this is that in that period, from 64 to 95 AD, we have no clear idea who was in charge, or which churches they controlled, or what schisms developed, or what disputes arose, or how they were resolved, or even whether they were resolved. We cannot know if the secret oral knowledge known to Paul and reserved for mature members of the church was accurately or devotedly passed on, or if it was, to whom, or in what ways it was altered. And we cannot identify anyone who was in a position to prevent the development of novel interpretations and beliefs. Even when Peter and Paul were still alive, the epistles reveal their inability to prevent such schismatic developments. So control of dogma must have been even less efficacious when no clear authority remained. And with no clear authority in control for 30 years, an entire generation, there is no limit to what can happen to an institution and its teachings, especially one built, at least in substantial part, on myths and secrets, two things that are the easiest to change.